And welcome back to Coast AM. We're continuing with our special report on the assassination 48 years now of John F. Kennedy. Up next, Barry Ernst joins us. His story, The Girl on the Stairs, and we'll tell you who that is in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about our guest this hour. Barry Ernst honed his skills as an investigative reporter and writer at newspapers in New York and Pennsylvania. A tip from a friend in 1967 that started him looking for answers to the JFK assassination. And his study of this subject over the years has led him to the Witnesses of Dallas, as well as the documents of the National Archives. And congratulations in order, Barry. Understand you got a pretty good featured speaker award in, where was it, in Dallas?
Yes, it was, George. It was at the JFK Lancer November in Dallas conference. It's a yearly event held by that organization, and it draws a lot of researchers and authors to the event. What they do is they give presentations on the area of their research, and a lot of people attend. Very, very well done conference.
Let's talk a little bit about how you really got involved in the John F. Kennedy assassination, and then we'll get into your work, The Girl on the Stairs. What happened?
Well, ironically enough, it was the first book by your previous guest, Mark Lane, that got me involved in it. I was in college at the time, and a classmate of mine, during a U.S. history seminar, in which I defended the Warren Report, actually, came up to me later and wondered why I was defending the Warren Report, and he mentioned a few things that were contradictory from his own reading, and he handed me a copy of the Playboy 1967 magazine, in which Mark Lane was the featured interviewee, I should say, and that sparked my interest in it, and I went out that afternoon and bought his book, Rush to Judgment, and was amazed at some of the things that I was reading in his book that I had not heard in the Warren Report, and the next thing I knew, I was in Dallas interviewing witnesses and at the National Archives looking for additional answers to that question. In his book, he casually mentioned a witness by the name of Victoria Adams, and that sparked my search for her. It was a very interesting story. She was a witness on the fourth floor of the building and came down the back stairs following the shots, an innocent story at that point, but it seemed incomplete to me, and so that's what got me into looking into her side of the story.
Did you find her, Barry?
I did. It took 35 years. It was a very difficult search, only because she did what she said she did, and that was in conflict with what the Warren Report wrote about her. And when she read her testimony, eventually, years later, in the 26th volume, she realized that they had altered her testimony somewhat. She saw the writing on the wall based on that and pretty much went into hiding. She had left Dallas by the time I arrived here in early 1968 in search of her, and there were no forwarding addresses. Every place I looked for her, every clue that I uncovered about her seemed to lead nowhere. And she couldn't be found, actually. I had a detective looking for her. I had various search banks looking for her, and I couldn't find her anywhere. She had moved about, left no forwarding addresses. She played it very low-key. She didn't even tell her best friends about what her background was, and therefore it was an easy thing to do because the Warren Commission basically wrote her off in two short paragraphs, and there was no way of corroborating any evidence that she mentioned in her testimony. And so she was basically ignored for the most part. And if she was mentioned at all in any of the books, it was usually in a very critical fashion.
What did the Warren Commission, Barry, say that she testified? And what did she say she testified to?
Well, what the scenario is, that in its 888-page report, her story was reduced to only two paragraphs. In a nutshell, what she did was, following the shots, the third shot, she and a co-worker who were on the fourth floor of the building, they were employees there, left that window and ran out through the rear office door and down the back stairs. When she got outside, she tried to make her way toward the railroad area of the grassy knoll because she had witnessed people running in that direction. She was turned aside by a policeman. She and the co-worker then went to the front of the depository. The co-worker returned to her office. Vicki Adams remained outside for a few minutes and then went back to her office. It was a very innocent act. She didn't realize the significance of it, right, even though in the months following that, she was pretty much hounded by authorities talking about what she had done that day. She was the only one singled out from her office. They asked her about the shots, how many shots she heard. She admitted she heard three shots. They didn't seem that interested in it. She told them that she saw the president's head explode following the third shot. They didn't seem interested in that. But as soon as she brought up the fact that she had ran down the stairs seconds after the final shot, moments after the final shot, then they were all ears. That seemed to bother them. She said she couldn't understand why, but they continually asked her about those questions. When the Warren report was issued, it dismissed her, even though it didn't do any of the time tests that it has done on other people involving the escape of Oswald. It didn't even mention in the Warren report that the woman, another woman, had accompanied her down the stairs. Her name was Sandra Stiles. We don't find that out until you go to the 26 volumes and examine Victoria Adams' testimony. It never interviewed Sandra Stiles, the woman who accompanied her. It never interviewed either of the two other women who stood at the window. In other words, it didn't do anything to either corroborate or discredit her testimony other than saying that, one, she was wrong and never came down the steps at that time, actually came down the steps later, and two, had somehow misrepresented the time that she had come down and actually descended after Oswald had already passed the fourth floor.
So she saw Oswald. She heard shots. But we still think they may have come from the grassy knoll as well, right?
Well, there is plenty of evidence, plenty of witness testimony. Now the House Select Committee acoustics evidence suggesting that a shot did come from the grassy knoll. The significance of her motion was that Oswald was on the sixth floor, according to the government, and descended those same back stairs after the shots were fired.
To get away. Right?
To get away, right. He went down those back stairs. He ducked into a second-floor lunchroom and was confronted by a Dallas police officer named Marion Baker and the depository building manager, Roy Truly, who had come up from the first floor. Both had been outside. Mr. Baker was in the motorcade, and Mr. Truly was on the front steps of the building. They had run inside and were attempting to get to the roof of the building where Marion Baker had seen pigeons fly up and thought something had occurred there. It was on the second floor that they confronted Oswald in the lunchroom. Baker seeing him through a little window in the doorway and going in and confronting him. It was Roy Truly then who said, "He's an employee," at which case Baker holstered the gun that he had stuck in Oswald's stomach, and they both continued up to the roof. Simple enough pattern, except for the fact that Victoria Adams was now saying she came down the stairs when she said she did, and she neither saw or heard anyone on those stairs at that time. Ironically, the Warren Commission said that if she is telling the truth, she should have seen or heard Oswald. It admitted that if she was telling the truth, she should have seen or heard Oswald, and the logic was simple. Because she had not seen and heard Oswald, then she is the one who is wrong with the timing.
Interesting. Now, the thing that confuses me, Barry, about Oswald is here he was apparently, you know, walking around the kitchen on the second floor, calm and collected. Had he just shot the president, I'm not sure he should be, but calm and collected. And then at what point if he indeed is the one who shot the police officer, J.D. Tippit, at what point did he escape and flee out the building? And what would make him leave at that point when he was calm on the second floor? That's what I don't understand. You would think he would just hang around.
Well, that speculation as to why he actually left. I don't really know why he left, but it is interesting that if he was descending from the second stairs and or from the sixth floor to the second floor lunchroom, it was a very tight schedule for him to do that. He had to get to the second floor, obviously, before the officer and Roy Truly came up from the first floor and saw him in that second floor lunchroom.
Right.
If he were escaping, you have to wonder why he would pause in the lunchroom to buy a Coke and then hurry down the hallway that was adjacent to the lunchroom to make his escape out the first floor doorway. It does tend to make you wonder why he wouldn't continue down from the sixth floor to the first floor and escape out the rear of the building. One could argue that he heard someone coming up from the first floor and therefore ducked in there, but why he would, and you'd have to understand the layout of the lunchroom, but going into the lunchroom, he basically cornered himself in there. Why he would then purchase a Coke, whether he did it prior to Baker coming in or after Baker coming in, I don't know. Why he wouldn't have continued out the hallway, as I say, that led from that door and make a hasty escape, I don't know. But it is true that he was very calm, cool, and collected when the officer confronted him. He left that lunchroom and was sighted by another woman in an office nearby, and she described him the same way, that he was very calm, casually walking through the office. He descended to the first floor and then left from the front entrance.
Just the whole thing is bizarre, Barry, isn't it?
It is indeed. And I think the significance of Victoria Adams and what she did is shown by what the Warren Commission did to discredit her. It clearly had an agenda, and Victoria Adams presented a thorn in the side of that. And what they did with her was, even though, and this is an interesting point, David Bellin, the Warren Commission attorney that was assigned to investigate this area of the investigation, or the so-called investigation, wrote to his boss on February 25th of 1964, in which he explained in detail the significance that Victoria Adams held and the fact that she had come down the stairs following the shooting. His final words were that he intended to fully resolve this issue. And he did not do that. He failed to do the time tests that were required, and he failed to interview the woman who actually had accompanied her down the stairs. Now, this is interesting because when I did find Victoria Adams, she told me that when she was questioned by David Bellin and before a stenographer had even entered the room to transcribe her testimony, he flat out told her he didn't believe a word that she was saying. And he said to the effect,
you're lying, basically, right?
Yeah, people do make mistakes, you know. Don't you think you could be wrong? And Vicky told me that she said, I could be, but I'm not. She was disillusioned by his immediate comment and told him, well, why don't you do the time tests with me that you have been doing with others? He refused. She asked him to interview Sandra Stiles for corroboration. He refused. His words to her were, we have you, we don't need her. And she was basically dismissed at that point and discredited by the mere fact that she had not seen Oswald coming down the stairs at the same time.
So give us the significance of her testimony, not before the Warren Commission, but with what she said.
Well, I think it proves a couple of things. First of all, we now know that she was telling the truth. There is cooperation from both Sandra Stiles and their supervisor, Dorothy Garner. I was able to find both of them, and they indeed verified that Vicky Adams and Sandra Stiles both left the window at the time they said they did, very quickly. In fact, Dorothy Garner was not questioned at all by the Warren Commission. She told me this past summer that she followed Vicki Adams and Sandra Stiles out the rear door to their office and saw them go down the stairs at that particular point, and then she remained in that location following their descent down the stairs and did not see anyone else come down the stairs after that. So we have definite corroboration. We have a document that was suppressed by the Warren Commission that was found in the National Archives. I found that in 1999.
All right. Well, why is her timeline important, Barry?
Her timeline is important because it puts her on the stairs at the precise moment that Oswald was supposed to have been coming down those stairs. And if she didn't see or hear Oswald, then it significantly alters the scenario that we're being presented with by the Warren Commission.
So you're saying, if I see this right, you're saying Oswald was already, even before the shooting occurred, was hanging around the second floor.
Well, that's an alternative, certainly an alternative. If he was on the sixth floor, he did not come down from that sixth floor at the time that the Warren Commission is telling us he did. The entire scenario of Oswald coming down, being confronted in the second floor lunchroom by Officer Baker and truly running up from the first floor is in jeopardy. We have to go back to what Oswald said during his interrogation, which obviously is based on notes rather than recorded testimony. But he did say that he was on the first floor at the time the shots were fired and then went to the second floor to retrieve a Coke from the
All right, but see, what none of this explains to us, and nobody can really tell us, is why the heck Oswald fled the building afterward. You would think he would just hang around, or, you know, I just don't understand why he escaped.
That's
or should I say left?
Yeah, to me, that indicates that there was some connection that he had with the assassination. He was not the only one to be absent from the building that afternoon. That is a misconception by a lot of defenders of the Warren Report. There are records indicating that he, as well as others, were not present for the roll call that was supposedly taken by Roy Truly that afternoon, his absence then being relayed to the police, and that's where the lookout occurred, the suspicion occurred on him being part of the assassination. Why he fled, I don't know. Why he took a bus, as the Warren Commission says he did, walked five blocks and took a bus back to the same area that he was fleeing from, who knows? But his behavior following the assassination was very strange. Certainly leads one to believe that he had some role in this, or at least mm-hmm. knew about it, or perhaps was being set up and recognized that. I don't know.
Yeah, I've always thought that, you know, he played some part in this, whether he was one of the three possible shooters, who knows. But but he must have known something. He was too connected to all the little players that whose names we continue to hear, don't you think?
Right. Well, he was a smart man. That's for sure. He's being portrayed as
an idiot, but he wasn't.
Right.
Barry, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back, take phone calls with you, Barry Ernest, our guest. The story, the girl on the stairs. We'll take your calls when we come right back. Now we're going to take your phone calls in a moment with Barry Ernest as we talk about his work, The Girl on the Stairs. Next hour, we'll talk about the late columnist Dorothy Kilgallen and what she might have known about the JFK assassination. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Barry, tell us a little bit about the official death certificate for JFK.
That's an interesting story. My mentor was Harold Weisberg, one of the noted critics and researchers on the case. And he often gave me a lot of what he called assignments. I was in the Navy at the time, and he thought that I could look for President Kennedy's official federal death certificate. Since it had been performed at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, he thought I would maybe have some insight. I started looking for it, could not find it, and The Warren Commission did not mention anything about it at all in their entire 26 volumes. And eventually, one day, while I was rummaging through some documents in the National Archives, it was in boxes of papers that had already been sent to the government printing office, which meant that all those documents had been printed in the 26 volumes. But I was rifling through there, coincidentally looking for the official testimony of Victoria Adams, when I found a file that had his death certificate located in there. I made a copy of it, of course, alerted Weisberg to it. The significance of it, however, was that there was a lot of controversy over the positioning of the wound in Kennedy's back. Obviously, it had to be high enough for the bullet to traverse Kennedy's neck and then go on to strike Conley, which the Warren Commission labeled the single bullet theory, the crux of the entire case, for if that is not the way it happened, then you had two assassins firing at Kennedy.
At least two, I would guess.
At least two, right. Yeah. What the death certificate showed was the statement by Admiral Berkeley, who was Kennedy's chief physician, who was never called by the Warren Commission. But his statement was that the wound to the back was at about the third thoracic vertebrae, which if you studied any human anatomy, which I did at that time because I wasn't familiar with the terminology, was at a position in the back that was verified by the hole in his coat and the hole in his shirt and the autopsy face sheet that was drawn and the witnesses who saw the back wound. And the importance of it was lower than the wound in the throat, which meant that if it were accurate, the bullet that entered at that point would have had to go upwards before exiting the throat and then somehow turned and go back down into Kennedy's back. That document was suppressed again. It was not included in any of the evidence. And fortunately, I was able to find it. When I asked Weisberg why he felt it had been put in there, his conclusion was that it was put in a position where it was not likely to be found. If everyone looking through the documents realized that those were documents that had previously been published in the 26 volumes, researchers would not necessarily want to look through that, figuring that the evidence or documents in there had already been made available.
Okay, let's take some calls here for you. We'll go to Ryan, first of all, in L.A., west of the Rockies. Hi, Ryan. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
This may be slightly off topic, but a while ago I heard about a project created by the CIA called Operation Northwoods.
Right.
And I heard that Kennedy banned the project and fired the general proposed project.
Do you know anything about that, Barry?
I'm familiar with the Northwood project. I don't. It's a little bit out of my realm. I would suggest that perhaps that question be directed back to Mark Lane, who wrote the excellent book, The Last Word. I know he provided you with the website where you could reach him, and I'm sure he fired the more authority to discuss the CIA issue than I would be.
Okay, good. Ryan, thanks for that. Jim, truck driving in Indiana. Go ahead, Jim.
Thanks, George. I've listened to you since before you were on Coast to Coast.
Thank you, sir.
My question, I got a quick one. Do you believe Oswald was with the CIA? And did he get to make trips from the U.S. to the Soviet Union back in them days? And my last question is, why do you think Teddy Kennedy never got to the bottom of it for the American people? And that's my question. Thank you.
All right.
Well, again, it's difficult to say whether he had connections with any intelligence agency. There are certainly indications of that. John Newman wrote a very good book called Oswald and the CIA, which sort of leads one to believe that he had intelligence connections. It's hard to imagine this lone nut, almost impoverished individual traveling as he did to the Soviet Union, leaving Dallas, going to New Orleans for whatever purposes with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, going to Mexico City. There's very, very suspicious activity, which seems to indicate a background in the intelligence field. Whether he had it or not, certainly we haven't been told one way or the other, other than the fact that the Warren Commission denied any connection. But there's certainly room for investigation in that respect as well. As to Teddy Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, there are some inside reports that Bobby Kennedy fully intended to open this investigation. He is quoted as telling his aides that he felt it would take the authority of a president to really get down to the bottom line on this. Naturally, he, in the public vein, as well as Ted Kennedy, had to display an image where they felt that the government had reached the final conclusion and a truthful conclusion to it. But behind the scenes, Bobby Kennedy is known to have been questioning the Warren Report. Ted Kennedy, I'm not as familiar with. I tried to interview him as part of this book, but his publicist said that he would not be interviewed by any book that was discussing the Warren Commission or its findings.
Did you ever hear the story, Barry, that he may have been talking to LBJ, asking him, you know, why did you kill my brother or have him killed? Did you ever hear that? Was that another myth, or was that any basis?
No, I did actually hear that. Whether it's rumor or not, I'm not sure. There were indications that Bobby Kennedy was leaning more toward reopening the investigation. There was a disagreement between the Kennedys and LBJ. Bobby Kennedy, in the initial stages, was very, very low-key with it, not making any accusations, not making any claims. But it's quite possible. It wouldn't surprise me that he would lash out that way and say something like that. After all, you asked the question of Mark Lane, who had the most to gain, and certainly LBJ was in that category.
It sure was. Okay, let's go to Boston, Mass. Tom's with us. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, gentlemen, great show.
Hi.
On the topic of Oswald witnesses, and I really like the story of the woman that saw Oswald coming down the stairs. So there were known to be a number of second Oswald seen before and actually after the shooting. The oddest one, I wonder if your guest has heard the story of this Army sergeant by the name of Robert Vinson, and he flew. He just happened to be trying to hitch a flight back from, I guess you can do this in the service, from Washington, D.C., from Andrews Air Force Base to his home back in Denver. He had some business in Washington, and I guess he was sitting there waiting. I guess you can just get on just about any plane that's going that way. He happened to get on a plane. The plane flew for a few hours. This is on November 22nd, 1963. And then it comes over that there are only like two people in the plane, and he's in the back. He's in the cargo area, and apparently they don't talk to him, the people that get on. But then they say the president was shot. They elbow south down to Dallas. They land by the river, and then they pick up somebody by the Trinity River, which is sort of in the neighborhood where Tippett was shot, who later the staff sergeant, Robert Vinson, recognizes as someone that looks like Oswald. He didn't know it at the time. He didn't know that the president, he didn't know anything about what was going on. So then, instead of flying to Denver, where he thought the plane was flying, they fly actually to Roswell, New Mexico. The people just get off the plane. The other Oswald, the pilot, the other guy, get off the plane. He's just kind of left there in the dark. Later, he gets off, and he thinks he's in Denver, and they say, no, he has to get a bus up to Denver, and he was not supposed to be on the plane, but he was on that plane. He wrote a book called Flight from Dallas, and he didn't tell his story until like 30 years later. I just wondered if he'd heard anything about that or had any other details about Robert Vinson.
I have heard that story. There were indications of a second Oswald or someone masquerading as Lee Oswald in this area, the Dallas area, prior to the assassination. Even Hoover, and I believe it was 1961, while Oswald was in the Soviet Union, wrote a memo saying that someone in the United States apparently was trying to use the identity of Oswald, which is very curious. But what's also interesting is the fact that in the months prior to the assassination, we have numerous reports of Oswald sightings in the Dallas area, and curiously enough, every one of them was detrimental to him later on, in which he was being portrayed as a former Russian defector. He was coming into money shortly and would be able to buy a car. He was a crack shot at local firing ranges, and going out of his way to draw attention to those details. The story that you just mentioned is simply one more in those cases. One of the things that I was taught early on in my research by Harold Weisberg was to be very careful with stories such as this, especially stories that come out later, in which witnesses suddenly emerge with these fantastic stories, and so you have to be very careful with that type of information. And until it can be verified and corroborated, it's nothing more than speculation and sometimes wild-eyed theories on the case. So without going any further into that or investigating it further, I have no basis to judge whether it's accurate or not. But
is Victoria Adams still alive, Barry?
No, she died in 2007. She had cancer. I knew her for 5 years. Interviewed her extensively over that time period. When the book was done and she knew the direction it was going in, and she was there, so to speak, as a supporter and verifier of any questions I came up with, she then told me that she had cancer and only had a few months to live from that point on. The doctors had given her a year, but she lasted about 3 or 4 months. And she told me that the reason she didn't say anything to me earlier than that was because she didn't want that to influence the way I was writing her story.
Interesting.
She had always felt that she was going to die with the truth. And I suppose you could say fate intervened and allowed me to find her in sufficient time to get her story down on paper before she passed away.
Let's go to John in Long Beach, California. John, you're on with Barry Ernest. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Real quick, I wanted to add something before I ask about Oswald.
Sure.
I am a journalist out here, and I worked at a paper in Long Beach. A guy I knew there knew a guy named Bill Hunter, who was a reporter in Long Beach, and it went out to Dallas to cover. He was originally from Wichita Falls and had new people in Texas that come out here from there. Went to Ruby's apartment and all that, gathered a lot of information, and about within a year, when he was in the police beat at one of the police stations in Long Beach, he got shot to death, ostensibly by two cops who were playing cops and robbers and dropped a gun and shot him. And I was hoping to talk to Mark Lane about that. It would probably be in his book, but a guy that knew him, that I got to know at the paper, who was still there, said he always felt that was related to it wasn't any accident. You know, it was just too convenient the way it happened. And to add him, you'd probably find him among the list of people that mysteriously died. The thing about, and I know I have to work move fast here. The thing about Oswald, I've always wanted to know, is Jim Garrison always thought that. I saw it on TV. Jim Garrison said he thought that Oswald was working, trying to foil a plot, to kill Kennedy, and then he realized because he had. Intelligence background that he was the fall guy. But the one thing that's always bothered me, and I wonder if you could ask about this, if Oswald was up in that sixth floor, Kennedy came right in front of him. Kennedy came within like 50 feet of him. You know, probably 60 feet down, or you're at the sixth floor, you're about 50 feet from the ground. He was right there in front of him. Why would he have waited for him to go like, you know, 0.2 miles down the street, down Stemmons Freeway or whatever, Parkway, what they call it, before he shot him? I always wondered if he wanted to kill Kennedy, he could have had him right in front of him. And I don't have, it hasn't been addressed very often. I can't remember. That's all.
Would have been a cleaner shot, to be sure. Barry,
right,
you know anything about that?
Well, it's true. If you go to the sixth floor museum, you can look out that window, and it's a very clear shot as Kennedy is coming toward the depository on Houston Street, the target getting very large in someone's sights. It is what appeared to be a much, much easier shot in that direction. Now, we have J. Edgar Hoover, who who addressed that in either his testimony or in a memo, saying that the reason Oswald didn't shoot in that direction was because there was a large tree blocking his view, and that is not true at all. The large tree that he's talking about is an oak tree that's situated in front of the building and actually blocked the view of the sniper if the motorcade turned left and went down Elm Street. Definitely, if you watch a car going down Elm Street from the sixth floor, it seems to be a much more difficult shot because the car is moving left to right as Kennedy's head is moving right to left and up and down, and it seems like the target is receding at that point and would be more difficult. The only thing that I can assume is if someone waited for there at that point, he waited until Kennedy was in what's called the kill zone with a shot perhaps from the front, from the grassy knoll, from other locations in a crossfire situation.
And if the timeline is correct by Victoria Adams, that she did not see Oswald in the stairwell when the Warren Commission said he should have been down there, what does that tell us?
It tells us that the scenario being presented to us between 12:30 and 12:33 on that day is wrong. It tells us that he either came down later, which would interfere with the timeline that moves from Oswald's escape from the building, and including the Tippit shooting. He either came down sooner than that, which is almost impossible at that point to get down as fast as he did, which then would beg the question of why he would wait in the second floor some 30 seconds for the officer and building manager Roy Truly to come up. Or he didn't come down at all. And if he didn't come down at all, of course, that opens a whole new can of worms. The fact that her presence on those stairs at that time presented that problem was the reason why, rather than investigate it completely, they chose to ignore and discredit her.
Just another piece of the puzzle, Barry. Thank you so much, Barry Ernest. His work is called The Girl on the Stairs, My Search for a Missing Witness to the Assassination of John F. Kennedy. Up next, we talk about the Kilgallen Files. Stand by for that.